I'm not sure I want to live in a world without Meatloaf. Meatloaf passed away, 74 years old, and we'll be listening to his music and musical contributions throughout the morning on the panel this morning. And, of course, the singer, whose Bat Out of Hell album was one of the best-selling albums ever. Of course, he played Eddie in the Rocky Horror Picture Show and died overnight, was, again, 74 years old. So we'll have all the music on our playlist, WAMC.org/roundtable. Coordinating the music was fairly easy. Mike does an amazing job putting all the music together. But today he just asked to borrow Malia's playlist. So it worked out pretty easy in this case. Malia, are you there?
I am here. Thank
the fact you didn't respond worried me. I was like, uh-oh, did I just tick off Malia?
Did you just say my name?
Yeah, I did. Well, good morning, everybody. Let me introduce you to the show and to our panel. Alan Chartok, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, old friend. Just fine.
Good. Good to hear. I hope you're keeping warm. It is a cold one.
No, that's impossible.
Yeah, it's a cold one.
I was just out with Murray the dog, and let me tell you, it wasn't a pleasant experience.
Yeah. Yeah, you freeze your little ears off when you're his size.
Yeah.
Well, good morning, everyone, and good morning, Alan. We also do welcome Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia DeMont. Good morning, Malia. What a pleasure to have you back.
Good morning. Thank you very much. And yes, it is cold, but it's actually perfect weather for hiking. I say this as a diehard. Winter hiking is the best.
All right. It is a good day for hiking. I would think you'd want maybe 10, 15 more degrees, but sure. Yeah, no, that's fine.
I'm going to break out the snowshoes. Yeah,
all right. Well,
great.
Good for you. Excellent. Aaron Pasitti is with us. He is the Siena College economics professor. Not the, but a Siena College economics professor. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. I'm excited for the cold weather because I think it's perfect weather for soaking in a hot tub.
Yes, absolutely. Keeping warm, doing whatever. It's all good stuff. David Soares is with us. He's the Albany County District Attorney, our good friend. Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm good. I just can't join this group with the advocating for these frigid temperatures, man. This is good weather for being right next to your stove and stirring a pot full of something.
Now, I'm with you.
Given your homeland, sir, I assume this is quite an adjustment. Let's put it that way.
It's quite an adjustment. You know, days like this, the only thing you do is get on your knees and pray for April and showers and like to move past all of this.
Well, we will do just that this morning, and we'll also talk about the news of the day, and we welcome you to do the same. All you got to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. All right, a lot to talk about, a lot going on, and we begin with Ukraine. This continues to be an issue. Talks are taking place as we speak in Geneva. Meanwhile, the president insists the U.S. won't accept a minor incursion by Russia into Ukraine after remarks drew criticism. The president insisted Thursday that the U.S. would not accept even a minor incursion as the White House continued efforts to clarify President Biden's remarks Wednesday, suggesting that it might. I have been absolutely clear with President Putin. He has no misunderstanding. Any assembled Russian units move across the Ukrainian border, that is an invasion, Biden told reporters Thursday at the start of a White House event on infrastructure. We should also note at this time, as stakes rise over Ukraine, U.S. and Russia pledge to keep talking. After meeting in Geneva, Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov signaled that diplomatic discussions would continue. The talks came amid signs that the U.S. and Europe lacked a coordinated plan to deter Moscow from invading Ukraine. Alan, what do you make of these developments?
Well, first of all, this ain't good. We know that. I mean, We know that Putin is one of the most cunning and, I think, evil men in the world right now, because he doesn't give a darn about anything except, you know, what will put him and his cause forward. And Putin is so cunning and so clever that you can be sure he is sitting there watching CNN on Russian television. I'm sure that he is watching to see what the American response is and will be to this. So I don't like it. I don't like it one bit. Clearly, there'll be a problem when he decides what to do with 100,000 people that he has sitting there on that border. I doubt very much he's just going to tell them to go home. But he is looking to find out what the American resolve is in all of this.
Malia Dumont, I'm fascinated by your perspective on this issue.
Well, I think Alan's right. I mean, Putin's a very clever man. And one of the things that he knows is that Ukraine is much more central to Russian interests than it is to U.S. interests. So U.S. attempts to deter Russia from invading by saying, we care about this and it's important and you're going to suffer consequences, aren't very convincing. I don't think that this attempt at deterrence is going to be very successful if we're just saying that economic sanctions are going to follow. I don't think that's going to be enough to deter Putin. I'm not in favor of this, but I really think the only thing that would really deter him is Western troops on the ground in Ukraine.
Aaron Pasitti.
Yeah, I think that the sanctions are kind of a toothless form of diplomacy. But I think in the Russian case, they will likely have less effect than they otherwise would, perhaps with other countries. I'm interested in this and kind of want to build on what Alan said, and that is that, you know, this is really the first time since 2016 with the Russian election meddling, when Putin's goal was just destabilizing the West. This is really one of the first, you know, substantial moves Putin has made to kind of test the U.S. and NATO's resolve in this. So it's like playing a game of chess where you have to think like three or four steps ahead. And Putin is clearly very good at that. And it's definitely nerve-wracking.
David Soares.
I think the thing that we see when it comes to North Korea, and we also see when it comes to Russia, is that they can get an audience with the most powerful nations whenever they you know, there's a spill on aisle 12, right? Whenever they stomp, or whenever they threaten with weapons testing. You will see them get an audience with the most powerful nations. Now, I think as far as Putin is concerned, we've allowed for, you know, this dog to grow and continue to grow. And if you look at the Obama administration, some it may have a valid argument that the Obama administration was not hard enough. But the Obama administration had, in fact, imposed a number of sanctions that it relied on the subsequent administration to impose. Well, not only did the subsequent administration not impose all of those sanctions, but it did not hold Russia's feet to the fire when it came to election interference and all of the other meddling that it had done, even in the Middle East. And so what we have right now is a person who is completely emboldened and, you know, It's a little genius as far as he's concerned by putting his troops on the border there and, again, holding the rest of the world hostage as he continues to make demands. I would think that even if you put aside the U.S.'s mishandling of a lot of affairs overseas and its foreign policies, and I cite to to its partnership with France and what it did with France over the submarines and the contracts with Australia. I would say that it is in the best interest of NATO to unite and to really be with the United States as it addresses all of these things that Putin are doing. But I don't think that NATO partners are also looking to take its lead from the U.S. I think that Russia poses a greater threat, geographically speaking, to our other allies in NATO. And so I think there will be a united front. But I don't know that this is necessarily I don't know that we're coming to the brink of conflict, of armed conflict on the border just yet.
What's he going to do with 100,000 soldiers, David?
Yeah. David?
I mean, one way to look at what Putin's doing with the 100,000 troops is he's effectively imposing economic costs on Ukraine by just the threat or the possibility of some level of invasion or a skirmish can, raise borrowing costs for a country. It can depreciate a country's currency, making international transactions more expensive. So this could be part of a longer-term strategy Putin may have in terms of just chiseling away at selected countries' economic resolve so that 10 or 20 years down the road, an actual invasion might be easier.
I also think that Putin is trying to assert Russian leadership more broadly. So today they also announced that they're going to be holding a series of large-scale naval exercises all around the world. And I'm surprised that nobody's been talking that much about what's been going on in Kazakhstan, which I think is another indicator of how Russia perceives its role in the region. So just quickly, for those who aren't aware, Kazakhstan is ruled by basically a dictator, the hand-picked successor to the previous dictator. And there were violent protests earlier this year. And so Russia sent troops into Kazakhstan, and they just left on Wednesday because that's my other phone ringing, trying to turn it off. they left on Wednesday because they were able to keep this dictator in power and quell the unrest, right? And Russia sent troops in through this organization called the Collective Security Treaty Organization that's made up of a bunch of former Soviet states. And I believe this is the first time the CSTO has sent troops into another country, another member country, not for just military exercises, but to actually quell domestic unrest. So Russia has been building these tools and is now using them to keep friendly states on its borders, and that's the same kind of thing it wants in Ukraine.
David, about 2 minutes.
Yeah, I think if you're an American and you've had a passing interest in foreign policy, right now is the time to pull a chair up to your computer or your television and pay close attention, because as much as I am worried about Putin and the efforts to rebuild his Soviet state. I'm also worried about China and what China does in this moment, where we seem to be locked in to what's happening on the Ukrainian border. And as Dr. Dumont has articulated, what's also happened in Kazakhstan. I think we're going to continue to see these aggressive displays by Russia. But Russia is starting off, I think, in a negotiation posture that is just impossible. In terms of how do you start out with asking that we no longer continue to build on NATO's progress and promise that we're not going to have any other, you know, nations joining NATO. I think it's an impossible place to even begin negotiations.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue conversations on this. We'll also welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Malia Dumont, Aaron Pasidi, and David Soares making up the panel this morning. We'll get some news from the BBC, and we'll return to our discussion right after this. Words to live by. 2 out of 3 ain't bad. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Malia Dumont, Aaron Pasidi, and David Soares. We welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Before I get to letters, does anybody have anything they want to add to what was said about Ukraine and our current situation?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, Joe, that that particular Meatloaf song is like the that's like the song. It's like the soundtrack to all of my rejections in middle school dances. Well, thank you for that.
Yeah. You know what, David? I think it's the soundtrack to all of our middle school rejections. But yeah, it does paint a picture, doesn't it? All right. Let's see. We'll go to letters. Dolly writes, my instinct is simply tell Putin remove the troops and vehicles by a given date or Ukraine will immediately move forward to join NATO. That from D. Please tell us. Panel, if you want to weigh in on any of the letters that I'm reading. Kathy writes, while we ourselves may not have figured out the U.S. is no longer the indispensable nation, it may even be on the verge of collapse. Russia and China clearly think that is the case, and they are positioning themselves accordingly. You think that's true, Alan?
No. No, I think the United States is still the major power in the world. Now, I do think that, you know, there will be those countries like China, like Russia, which will stick it in the ribs every once in a while. But I don't think you can argue with the amount of military, economic, and other powers that this country has. So, yeah, I would say that.
Meanwhile, Kenneth says, I would like to make the point that as the U.S. appears to be more and more diminished on the world stage and more disunited at home, and with Britain no longer a part of the EU, Vladimir Putin is seizing his opportunity to be more assertive and bellicose. Malia, thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree. And with the previous letter, I agree with the half of the sentence that talked about Russia and China taking advantage. Same kind of thing. I agree with Alan. I don't think the U.S. is on the verge of collapse, but Russia and China see an opportunity. And the world order, the current world order, is not one that is completely advantageous to them. So they're going to try to remake it as much as possible, and they see opportunities now. And I think they're going to continue to capitalize on them. I don't think that Russia and China are natural close allies, but when they have coincident interests, you'll find them working together.
Malia, as long as we're talking, and with your military background, the question I have is, China, I think, has the horses, but does Russia really have the horses to threaten the United States in any way militarily?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, do you mean threaten us by sending troops over the border into a NATO country, or?
Well, yeah. Well, look, this is a KGB colonel. He hasn't changed a whit, right? Putin hasn't. He was a Soviet. Now he's a something else. I don't know what you want to call him or what he wants to call himself. Nevertheless, there are overtones of military threat here. You put 100,000
right,
people
yeah.
on a border, yeah. And so the question yeah. is, does he have the horses and the ability to do that? I ask you that as an expert.
Oh, right. Okay. So
I
just have to clarify that I am representing myself and my personal opinion and not the
of
U.S.
course,
Army
yeah.
or the Department of Defense. I don't think the questions to look at are not just capabilities, but capabilities and intent. And as we've previously discussed, Putin is not a dumb guy. So he's I don't think that he would directly threaten the United States. Clearly, he has a lot of troops, but the U.S. continues to be the preeminent military power in the world. Our capabilities far outmatch those of Russia. Could he cause trouble for us in Ukraine? Absolutely. But I don't think the question of whether Putin is going to directly threaten the U.S. military is one that's going to come up.
All right, let's go to another letter. This one from John. Speaking of dictatorship, shouldn't we be all worried about whether there will be one in 2 years? All right, I think
of course we should. Of course we should.
I think we've talked about that, but yes. Let's see. I'm afraid that unless Biden, this is from Russ, I'm afraid that unless Biden announces that U.S. military troops will be sent to Ukraine now, Putin will order a Russian invasion into Ukraine first. I have no idea what that would look like and how the American public would react to it. What do you folks think about about this? Thanks from Russ. Anybody want to weigh in on that?
I just don't see any kind of benefit from sending troops at this point in time without also seeing the opposition escalate these tensions. I'd also like to add that you know, although there are some people that may smirk at the idea of sanctions, let's not forget that we didn't impose all of the sanctions that the previous administration, not the Trump administration, but the Obama administration. We didn't follow through on the imposition of all of those sanctions. And, you know, just to also add for a moment here, when we're talking about, you know, geopolitical nations and the struggles that we all seem to have, is that there are inner tensions as well. Russia is not within their tensions within their own countries, their political tensions, as is China. And so I think there is a strategy there to, you know, impose sanctions that really get at the heart of what we're trying to achieve. And so Putin's only thing that he has is just like North Korea. It's force. It's muscular force. It doesn't have the ability to do anything else because of its fledgling economy. And so I think as we're, you know, continuing to engage in these diplomatic discussions, we cannot ignore all of the various tools that we as a nation have in our toolbox.
Alan?
I agree with him. And I thought I said something like that. David Soares, being much smarter than I am, made it clear that this is a country with great resources, economic and others. I mean, it's one thing to argue about economic resources with China. China has a lot going for it right now. They make half the world's stuff. But I don't think, you know, I don't think Russia has a lot at its disposal. Putin may want to build himself up that way, but I don't see that as being something that is going to work.
Aaron, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, sanctions can be effective. It obviously depends on just how aggressively and widespread they're imposed. But I have to imagine, and I'm just speculating here, that Putin is well aware of the menu of sanctions that Russia could face because of this. And I think he's probably just trying to take the temperature of what the U.S. response is likely to be. So, you know, part of the fact that the sanctions are toothless means that Putin is expecting them, I would assume, and knows that Russia could somehow, you know, weather the storm through a international financial network of, you know, oligarchs around the world. So I think he's probably well aware of that. And like I said, he's probably just, you know, trying to get a sense of just how far the U.S. will go.
You bring up a great point, Aaron, and something I'd like to ask you about. When we so often talk about sanctions, what do they really mean? And ultimately, when they're financial, how long does that take to really kick in to make a difference?
Sure. Well, it could obviously, it could restrict flows of money into and out of Russia. So for, you know, the Russian government might invest in U.S. and, you know, Chinese assets and, you know, money that's deposited overseas, particularly in the U.S., could be frozen. So it can dry up a source of financial resources for Russia. You know, there could be limits on, you know, U.S. companies investing in Russia. But it primarily the flow of financial resources into and out of a country. With a globalized financial network and, you know, with countries that, you know, might not have the same international policy stance as the U.S., you know, the effect of those sanctions are much weaker than they might have been in the past.
We have heard over and over again, Aaron, that Putin has a vast fortune invested around the world. Do you think any of that enters into, and I'm sure the United States is part of that, do you think there's anything that will tighten the leash on Putin as a result of that?
You know, that's a good point. You know, I think the answer is probably not. Just because of, you know, Russia's ability to, particularly with oil revenue and the coddling of, you know, Russian oligarchs, there are probably very large, safe buckets of money placed around the world. So even if the U.S. imposes sanctions, you know, that can impose a cost on Russia. But like I said before, I think Putin has probably factored sanctions into the, you know, the troops on the border. So I would guess that Russia probably has enough to weather the storm of U.S. sanctions.
I want to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have many letters. I want to get to those, and we'll move on to other topics as well. Alan Chartok, Malia Dumont, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares all making up the panel. We'll break, but we'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We are remembering Meatloaf, who passed away at the age of 74. We have all the music posted or will be posted on the playlist WAMC.org/roundtable. WAMC.org/roundtable. All right. We have letters. I want to get to those before the top of the hour. We go. We go to Gary, who says, as we learned in Iraq, occupy a hostile area is expensive. Other than blocking NATO, what does Putin gain by the control of the Ukraine?
Well, distraction, among other things, right? Distraction from his own people, you know, the constant history that we have observed of Russia, the Soviet Union first, Russia now, trying to find its place in the world. And by doing this, he makes the argument that they're relevant.
Malia?
Access to relative warm water ports. I mean, Russia's geography is striking. Largest landmass of any country. And yet, within the borders of Russia, all their ports are so far north. It's really hard. So Crimea has historically been very, very important to the Russian economy.
All right, let's go to... go ahead, Aaron. Go ahead, Aaron.
Can I chime in?
Absolutely.
You know, I think one other interpretation is that, you know, Ukraine is very rich in natural resources. There's probably a pool of relatively low-cost labor. So, you know, I think in Putin's grand strategy, Ukraine would be probably one of the, you know, the first dominoes to fall in his ideal world. But, you know, reclaiming former Soviet republics just expands the labor force and the natural resources on which, you know, the Russian economy largely depends.
Nancy writes, when I hear you talk about Russia and China, all I can picture is the velociraptors in Jurassic Park constantly checking the fences, Hopefully, in the case of the United States, they never penetrate the weak area. Ellen says, certainly Putin's series of actions and infiltrations since 2016 are aggressive. Are there any present monitors in place observing Trump's interactions with Russia? David, what do you think?
Trump's interactions with Russia? I believe that if Trump at this point was engaging with Russia in any way, shape, or form, there would be information that would be coming back to various agencies under the Department of Justice, because the one thing that we are proficient at and we continue to do, even with our most peaceful of partners, is that we spy on them. And so if there was anything that would be alarming, I'm sure that we would our government would be taking action right now against the former president.
Do you agree with that, Alan?
No.
I sort of thought so. Yeah.
I mean, my sense is that we haven't shown the cojones to do what's necessary, and that includes our security agencies being as transparent as my very good friend, a man I much admire, David Soares, indicates. I don't have that kind of faith in our security apparatus. Maybe Malia, who is closer to some of this than we are, could tell us what she thinks.
Well, thanks, Alan. I'm actually not sure it's even necessary from the Russian point of view for them to be in touch with Trump right now, because he already shares a lot of commonalities with Putin. His view of America's interests in the world isn't that different from where Putin thinks America should be engaged in a lot of ways. So I don't know if Trump was trained well previously or however that happened, but I had an interesting conversation with a colleague in foreign affairs and asked him what he thought would be happening right now if Trump were president. And he said, well, Trump would probably just say, okay, Putin, you can have Ukraine. We don't care about that. That's far away. That's not an American interest. We don't care what happens there. And I don't think that that Trump needs a lot of Russian coaching to arrive at that kind of hypothetical statement. That's my view.
I certainly agree with that. What I think the only point that I was making, Alan, is simply this. You have people that are constantly monitoring the behavior of our enemies and also the behavior of our friends. And certainly with his 4 years in office, that man was given access to information that no one else would have. And the idea, I wouldn't put it past him to traffic and to attempt to make monetary gains from that information. But the idea that he would be out there in any way, shape, or form trafficking in that information and very serious security related issues, and we wouldn't do a thing, that I just don't see that happening. That is the entire purpose and function of our government in protecting American interests.
Well, David, if you take a look at Trump and his character and his penchant for taking public resources to make private money, I don't think you can put anything past him. We do know that he had this relationship with the Russians, which has become very unclear, having to do with hotels and gifts to foreign leaders and things of that kind. I would not put it past him to be doing what he has always done in order to increase his own wealth and his own prestige.
Let's go back to letters, and we go to this one from Sasha, who says, I'm a little worried about the situation as a whole. Presently, with Ukraine not being part of a major European alliance, there is technically nothing forcing the U.S. or other European nations to help defend its solidarity. And yet, if Russia takes over Ukraine and then goes on to take yet another vulnerable and largely defenseless nation, Belarus, not an unlikely possibility, Russia will have regained a significant portion of its former USSR footprint in Europe and gained yet more power. What then? Will we just shake our heads and say we should have done more? I'd love to hear your thoughts on our options. Malia, what are your thoughts on our options?
Our options. That's a very good question. I think that you know, the U.S. has important alliances around the world, and we need to continue to shore those up. I'm not sure that we can stop Putin from invading a country right next to him if that's what he decides to do. Even though I don't think that economic sanctions in themselves are going to be very effective, I think it was David who called them toothless, we shouldn't lay them aside. We should continue to work with our allies and try to send the message that that this kind of behavior is unacceptable in the world order that we're trying to uphold here. But there aren't really a lot of good options. I mean, American power is on the wane in some ways. I'm not saying this is not a value judgment. It's just what's happening. Russia and China in particular are on the rise, and we have to find different mechanisms to continue to support the kind of liberal institutions that have helped the world stay largely at peace. But I think we're looking at a world in the next, 10 years that is going to have a lot more tensions in it, that there are going to be a lot more disputes like this. It's just going to be a much more difficult place to for the United States to continue to exercise leadership. And we're going to look back nostalgically on those immediate post-Cold War years of relative stability.
You know, it may well be that Trump is elected. Look, this is not a prediction I have any great hope for, obviously. But it may be that Trump gets elected president again. We do know that he has had this strange relationship with the Russians, economically, personally, Nancy Pelosi said all roads, lead to Putin. You can't count Trump's influence with the present Russian, old Soviet group of people, including Putin. So I find it very scary, nor do I take any solace in the fact that this country has a unified approach to what it's doing.
I just want to get in two letters here before. Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's interesting that, and of course, leave it to WAMC to do this, but you have, two people on your panel today with incredible expertise that, for example, we're not living in the 40s or the 50s where we count nuclear missiles and we measure our strength based upon the number of nuclear missiles at our arsenal. We've basically created a global economy, and we exert a lot of authority and power through the various levers of our global economy. So, I don't think while we cannot afford to be deploying 100,000 people to another nation to defend its borders, I do think that there are so many levers, economic levers, that we've yet to really to pull on, along with the multilateral partners that we have in all of this, which is why when I see America offending, France, it's a problem. When we decide to pull out of Afghanistan, and according to the documents that you read, we did so without, a lot of lead time and warning to our allies, that's a problem. And so, that adds to the complexity of this current administration's task. It's about restoring, rejuvenating, strengthening our relationships at the same time, taking on these powers that pose a threat not only to ourselves, but our other, nations around the world.
We are up against a break. I just want to get to two letters before we go, and that way we can start fresh with new topics when we return. Paul is criticizing us for demonizing Russia. Why the knee-jerk reaction? Always to demonize other countries. If Russia and China had a military alliance with the nations of South and Central America and was planning to incorporate Mexico into their alliance and install missile and weapon systems there, I'm pretty sure there would be a massive military response. So why is the demand of Russia not to have hostile military installations placed in Ukraine seem to be part of some demonic plan? Why is there no discussion whatsoever of the legitimacy of their request and security operations? Finally, we go. Go ahead.
Was that letter from Boris?
I find it very interesting that, the writer seems to think that Russia should have equal equal say over what Ukraine wants as the Ukrainian people.
Very good point. And the last letter before we go to a break, Vladimir Putin got Crimea, Donald Trump, but maybe not Ukraine. So as the great Meatloaf said, two out of three ain't bad. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 21st of January, 9 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. Alan Shartok, Malia DeMond, Aaron Pasetti, and David Soares making up the panel. We welcome your letters at panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Moving on to other topics, one of the lead stories in the Washington Post this morning is something I thought we could weigh in on, especially you, Aaron Pasetti. Workers are out sick in record numbers, exacerbating labor shortage woes. That is the headline. The latest surge of coronavirus cases powered by the Omicron variant has caused extremely high numbers of employees to miss work because of illness, exacerbating the country's persistent labor shortages and threatening to complicate the labor market's push toward pre-pandemic employment levels. Between December 29th and January 10th, approximately 8.8 million workers reported not working because they were sick with the coronavirus or caring for someone who was. That according to new data from the Census Bureau. Those numbers are nearly triple the levels from the first 2 weeks of December before cases had started to peak around the country. They were also the highest numbers since the agency started taking the survey in April of 2020, well over last January's peak of 6.6 million workers out. How big of a long-term problem is this, Aaron?
Good question. There's the short-run impact, which is just the continued staffing headaches, businesses open for fewer hours, businesses that are closed. So some of those consequences are more short run. I think the bigger, longer term issue here is that, again, the trajectory of the virus will determine the trajectory of the economy. So you're going to see unpleasant economic outcomes, and it's likely not going to be rising unemployment like it was in the spring of 2020. But I think what you're going to see here is a combination of increased financial strain for households. So for, you know, workers who don't go into work because they have Omicron or they have to care for somebody who does, you know, that reduces their income. So those workers have to tap into their savings. It creates an increased likelihood of food insecurity, an increased likelihood of eviction, increased likelihood of mental health problems that are associated with this. So there are very real long-term impacts of this. And, you know, the original COVID relief package wasn't designed to be an economic stimulus. It was designed to keep households financially stable during a very tumultuous period. So the concern now is if this problem, you know, stays with us for a couple months as, you know, Omicron plays itself out nationwide, that this financial damage could be very long lasting. So there's that aspect of it. Another longer term aspect of this is that, you know, as businesses face this COVID labor shortage on top of an existing labor shortage, you're going to see higher wage pressures in certain industries. You know, with workers who, you know, might be truck drivers, that means goods aren't getting from, you know, the plant to the retail outlet. All of those forces are likely going to put upward pressure on inflation, which is already at 7%. The risk is that, and the Federal Reserve has made this very clear that they're going to start raising interest rates in the spring of 2022, largely to cool down the economy, to kind of tamp down, you know, consumption growth and spending, to get a, you know, to try to put a lid on inflationary pressures. The downside of that is when the Fed cools off the economy by raising interest rates, by making the cost of borrowing more expensive, that can lead to slower growth and higher unemployment over you know, the subsequent years. So this is a very real threat, and it's more than just, well, you know, there was an inconvenience around the holiday season because of this labor shortage. This has the potential to last a couple years, depending on how it plays out. And I think one of the biggest problems is, you know, for economists and policymakers, is not knowing exactly how it's going to play out. The climate is changing so rapidly, and we have such a divided Congress that any type of relief, whether it's, you know, extending the eviction moratorium or increasing the provision of nutrition assistance to families, that's kind of off the table at this point. So the financial strain it can cause and some of the problems that arise from that are worrisome, in addition to the rising inflation that might cause, which could lead to, like I said, slower growth and higher unemployment in the years to come.
So what are the partisan, Aaron, so what are the partisan political implications of all of this?
Well, yeah, no, that's a good question, because, you know, obviously it's largely a marketing issue. I've said this before, and I know it's a minority opinion, and I hope people don't take my words out of context, but COVID is good for Republicans because it creates chaos. It creates anxiety. It creates uncertainty. And Republicans have been very good on capitalizing on that, largely by, you know, bombastic, strong-armed political candidates that, you know, are going to claim to take a hold of it. And Republicans can also point to this as a failure of the Biden administration's COVID and economic response. Then you have the higher inflation that's likely to result from this. So Republicans can tap into that vein in the 2022 midterms. So, you know, this develop, and it really pains me to say this, is that, you know, the worse the economy gets, the worse COVID gets, the better it is for Republicans. So Republicans likely see this as an opportunity and an advantage. And I don't see much benefit for this for Democrats or the Biden administration in the 2022 midterms.
David, you were about to say?
Well, I wasn't about to say anything. On the economy, I usually leave to – I'm the guy with the jacket coming over, James Brown, the doctor of economics. But this is going to continue to be politicized. We're going to continue to suffer because, as the good doctor has said, there's political hay to be made here. And so in terms of signing off on any kind of relief package to address the current woes in our economy, I doubt that we have the Republican Party that will be willing to roll up its sleeve and lend a hand and to get that done because it plays to their political benefit. So, yeah, this will continue to be politicized. It's so difficult. This pandemic is difficult on a lot of people. Take it from a person who's attempting to manage an office of people who, from week to week, you don't know how many people are coming in. You don't know, you know, in terms of family members of those very people that you rely on and what they're experiencing. This is not going away. And again, I think that our focus on numbers and reporting on numbers of infections, it doesn't tell the whole story.
Malia, anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, sure. So the data in the article is from a couple weeks ago, and as one of the economists in the Washington Post article says, the only silver lining is that it tends to go quickly. So I think we're probably past that that immediate post-holiday surge of infections. But I agree that the bigger issue is the long-term economic implications. I mean, someone's out for a couple of days because they get sick, and it's when they come back, it's not just right back to normal when you have shortages. It has a ripple effect. And I think there hasn't been enough study and understanding of how those ripple effects occur and what the long-term implications of them are. I've been trying to think of an analog. You know, when else in American history have we had kind of, you know, a labor shortage, a mass labor shortage? And I think, you know, World War II, when so many people went off to fight, and one of the silver linings of that was that it gave a lot of opportunity to women to enter the workforce. It's a little bit different now. I'm not sure if there are any underprivileged sectors of the workforce that are able to, you know, benefit from this situation, because so many of them are in the sectors that are most affected by Omicron. So it's a really difficult time, especially for those who are already economically disadvantaged.
Let's go ahead. Did anybody else want to?
Well, Joe, I guess this would hijack it and probably change it from the very good economics stewardship that we're hearing from Aaron. But we had one letter from somebody who wanted to know if David Soares thought that the Atlanta DA impaneling a grand jury basically to look at Trump was something that he wanted to comment on.
If that's where we're going, yes, there's a lot to comment there. And I think it's a major development in that investigation.
All right, so let's go there. What do you think?
Okay. Yeah, you know, so local district attorneys like the district attorney in Fulton County, we have grand juries that function on a daily basis. And, for example, here in Albany County, under normal conditions, we have three sitting grand juries. They're impaneled. They sit with us for 8 weeks. We put a number of cases in front of them. Cases range from burglaries to robberies, rapes, homicides. They will listen to everything. But when a local prosecutor is looking to impanel a special grand jury, it means one thing. It means that the issue that's before that prosecutor is large in scope, investigation large in scale, and the issues are complicated. And what you need is more than the traditional 8 weeks or 4 weeks to address, you know, those issues. And so what the DA has done here is the DA has sought a special grand jury that will sit and will come in only when the DA is looking, you know, to present evidence to them. And they will be sitting for as long as the DA's office needs them to complete their investigation. Could be 6 months, could be a year. If it needs to go beyond a year, that DA could also seek extensions. But that's a significant development in this investigation, because what it also speaks to is that the DA's office and their investigators have done all the work that they possibly can do. They've obtained all the records. They've reviewed all the records that they can. They've spoken with a whole host of people to obtain more information. And they still need to conduct, you know, the remnants of this investigation, meaning you have people that don't want to cooperate with the investigation. So they need a subpoena from a grand jury. They're not going to go to their temporary grand juries or traditional grand juries. So that's why they're seeking authorization from a superior court judge to implement this. If you're part of the Trump team, if you're his former chief of staff, this is the kind of news you did not want to wake up to on a Friday.
First of all, say hi to the baby for us. Second of all, what does it mean for
the, I guess, just the overall, the idea of a grand jury, of where that, at what level, how does that change the level of the investigation? And if you are, and again, if you're the Trump administration, do you, I mean, you're not happy about this, right? Or the Trump, whatever.
Absolutely not. As a general practice for me, only because I know there'll be questions, regardless of how a grand jury votes, there's going to be questions. So we tend to err on the side of transparency. Now, you do know that when you subpoena a record to the grand jury, you cannot discuss, you know, the contents of that record. You can't even discuss whether or not you've subpoenaed a specific item to the grand jury. And so when an investigation is over, and let's just for purposes of a hypothetical, grand jury decides not to indict, and the public wants to know, you know, well, what did you present to them? You're precluded from providing anything that you subpoena to a grand jury to the public. Can't share it. But all the records that you obtain outside of that subpoena and without the assistance of that grand jury, those records you can share. So what this is telling me is that this DA has thoughtfully mapped out the investigation. So they've gone about obtaining as many records as they can. They've exhausted those methods, and now they want a grand jury in order to subpoena either witness testimony or records to that grand jury. Now, sometimes when you have witnesses that say, okay, well, I'm not coming in to talk to you, what they're really saying is, hey, look, I know the victim, or I know the defendant in this case, and I don't want to create the appearance that I'm cooperating against that person in your investigation. So I'll come in and talk to you if I'm subpoenaed, because I'm going to follow the law. And that's exactly what you have here with Raffensperger, that publicly stated that, hey, look, I'm a Republican. I'm running for reelection. I'm not interested in you know, cooperating against my party, but I am going to obey the law. So if you subpoena me, I will go in and I'll provide truthful testimony. That is not unusual, and that's exactly what is happening now.
Alan, anything you want to add to that?
No, I found it very exciting, to tell you the truth. This district attorney decided that she would impanel this grand jury, that they would look into this obvious Trump stuff that so few people are looking into, and that it might really lead somewhere. I hope I'm right.
Malia?
Yeah, I agree. So it's interesting. You know, I have a lot of faith in the American justice system, and I think this is a reminder of how careful you have to be with the law, because this isn't something that people have been working on this for a long time, right? This is over a year later, and the investigations are unfolding, and we're seeing a lot of developments in the January 6th. Investigations. And so I think this coming year, there are going to be a lot more of these kinds of activities in various places around the country. And as I think there should be, this is, you know, people have to be held accountable, and our legal system can't ignore attempts to bypass it. So just as an aside, I wanted to share that one of the headlines today in the Kingston Daily Freeman is that a Kingston native who graduated from high school here is now a sheriff somewhere in upstate New York, northwest New York, has wrote public letters in support of January 6th conspirators, and is planning to run for the Republican governor in New York. So. You know, we're looking at Georgia here with this particular story, but you know, the implications affect us in New York, and I think we're just going to continue to see a lot of ripples from this.
Aaron, have about a minute and a half before break.
Yeah, this, you know, reading that article, you know, hearing about racketeering charges, conspiracy charges, fraud charges. You know, if you redacted the names, you would think you were reading about a mafia boss in New York City in the 1950s or something. And, you know, the Trump machine is largely a, you know, organized like the mafia, where, you know, there's loyalty and then there's strong arm tactics, and holding those individuals accountable, as Malia said, is exceptionally important. This is something that we just can't let slide. So, yeah, it'll be very interesting to see how these criminal investigations play out.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Last call for the letters, and we'll move on to other topics when we return as well. Alan Chartok, Malia Dumont, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares, we do welcome your input. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we will continue right after this break. Sorry if I'm hoarse. I was singing at the top of my lungs during the break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Final go-around with our wonderful panel, Alan Chartok, Malia Dumont, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares. You were singing too, weren't you, David? You know you were.
I have a card that I need on the streets here. You know, I can't divulge that kind of stuff. You know what I'm saying?
I got a card on the streets. Okay. All right. Let's go to other stuff that we want to talk about. Oh, here's something that's horrible and yet fun to talk about. Our friend Mitch McConnell yesterday put his foot in it, didn't he? He said he waved off voting concerns since black people turn out as heavily as Americans. Yes, he said that into a microphone on purpose. Shortly after the Senate voted down a proposed change to filibuster rules, thereby dooming a Democratic push to implement federal voting standards, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and other top Republicans held a brief news conference. At the center of the debate over implementing national early vote and mail ballot baselines was concern that non-white voters have been targeted both directly and indirectly by new restrictions. When the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in the 2013 Shelby County versus Holder decision, states that previously had to have voting law changes vetted by the Justice Department were freed to do so without review. That included Georgia and Florida. A reporter raised the most extreme version of concerns about that change to McConnell, referring to the legislation that would no longer move forward. What's your message for voters of color who are concerned that without the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, they're not going to be able to vote in the midterm? McConnell replied, well, the concern is misplaced because if you look at the statistics, African-American voters are voting in just as high a percentage as Americans. As you would expect, the phrasing was poorly received. David, I will let you begin the chorus.
You know, not that it's funny, and I do not mean to laugh, but look, Mitch McConnell is saying the quiet parts out loud. Mitch McConnell is part of a party that has taken, I would say it's not just taken a turn, it's just veered off of its path. And we used to call them dog whistles. They're no longer dog whistles. They just say it all out loud. And one thing that I would say about people focusing so much on Mitch McConnell for what he said or his phrasings, I'd focus more on Mitch McConnell and his policies and the way that he's managed the Republican Senate since he's been leader, since he's been a leader there, and that he has not voted in the interest of not only Americans of color, but he's not voted in the interest of Americans, period. But this is Mitch McConnell. So the fact that he used this phrase and this what we could say was inarticulate, and we could say that he probably didn't mean to say it that way. The reality is that his actions are a lot more offensive than the way that he framed that particular response. It's embarrassing. It's a shame. We're watching an incredible party, a party that is a necessary party in our body politic, not only manipulate politics by gerrymandering and packing votes, but we're also seeing now efforts to decide whose votes count as well as diminishing the ability of others to vote. So to me, it's just one large bag of nonsense and undemocratic policies that are being pushed forward by a party and its leader.
Alan.
Well, you know, I have very little to add to that. I think David speaks, as always, with great wisdom. However, I do think that we have a guy, McConnell, who is widely disliked in his own state, you know, and who has this outsized power in the United States of America. So here you have, you know, a senator who is not perceived well by his own constituents, and who still can tell everybody else in the country what to do. It keeps coming up in my head, and it's very unhappy. My head is very unhappy, let's put it that way.
Aaron.
Yeah, no, I think this highlights a lot of what the modern Republican Party is about, and they're not interested in governing. They're not interested in preserving democracy. They're interested in preserving their power. And that's not, I mean, all politicians to a certain extent are interested in preserving their power, but this seems to be more than just, preserving some Republicans' seats in Congress. This is about fundamentally shaping what direction the country is going. And as David pointed out, you know, gerrymandering, making it, stacking the deck, essentially, making it more difficult for Black people to vote is an absolutely 100% necessary component for Republicans to preserving their power. So, you know, the fact that McConnell was saying that, you know, the turnout of Black voters was more or less the same as all Americans, like, that's a serious problem for Republicans. And that's why 19 states since 2020 have enacted very restrictive voting laws.
Malia.
Yeah, there are a lot of problems with this statement, obviously. I agree with whoever says a bag of nonsense and bad policies. And one of the things I have a problem with about it is it's very backwards focused. African-American voters, quoting McConnell, African-American voters are voting in just as high a percentage as Americans. He's looking back like 10 years ago and refusing to address or acknowledge what was just referenced, all these new restrictions that Republicans are pushing to put in place across the country. So that's clearly not a problem for him. He doesn't want to address that. And then also, let's just consider the fact that Americans overall don't have a really great record of turning out in high percentages to vote in elections. So saying that our relatively low voting percentage is good enough, it isn't something you want to hear from an elected leader. I mean, we want more people to vote. We want more citizens to be engaged in our democracy. And so saying sort of it's good enough, it should never be the answer.
Anybody else?
Yeah, this is part of my frustration watching all of the political dynamics play out in Washington right now. What occurred during this past presidential election was a massive, massive effort to turn states that have traditionally voted Republicans to vote Democrat. And what happened in Georgia and what happened in Arizona is just it's simply unbelievable that we now have senators that are representing those states that are Democrats. But what have they done in the period of time that they've been there to go back to the same voters and say, hey, come on, we need you again during the midterms? And this is where the perfect becomes the enemy of the good. And I understand that, look, there's a lot that has to be done legislatively to put this country on the right tracks, whether it's economics, whether it's environmental, criminal justice. But this idea that, you know, here we're coming into office and we're just going to get everything done in the first year, it's a bit absurd, and I think we'll pay for it in the midterms.
Alan, what do you think?
Well, I think you're going to pay for it in the midterms anyway, David. As we all know, historically, cyclically, this is not a good time. The president's in office. His party gets trounced in the congressional elections. One would expect that something like that is going to happen here. Although, you know, you have a very strange set of circumstances here with Donald Trump and with people being indicted and grand juries being formed. Some of that may leak into the population. However, there doesn't seem to be any real deviation in the Republican Party itself. The Bushes and whatever moderation they brought to it, even Cheney, who was regarded by most of us as really, you know, a bad right-winger guy, they're out. And it's the party of Trump now, and it will continue to be that way for a while, I'm afraid.
All right. Let me go to some, let's see, we just have about 3 minutes. So let's go to some letters here, and we'll fill out the time that way. Mitch McConnell continues to uphold his promises of more than a decade not to allow Democrats to succeed anytime, anywhere, writes Melinda. Even as the minority leader, he rules the Senate to this day. His vile comments yesterday just say that they were all thinking, as David Soares points out. Nina says, missing the point, question mark. The statement of McConnell puts forth the assumption that African Americans are separate from Americans. Are Americans only white? David says, appreciate the dialogue. A key point was just made that you all flew over. We want more of our citizens to be able to vote. Why is it so unreasonable to require citizenship? What say you, panel? Anyone?
What do you mean?
I don't even know. I don't even know what that means.
What do you mean? You mean a gun? A gun? You know, at one point in the old Soviet Union, they had 100% turnout, and that's because you better turn out or you're going to get shot. So, what do you mean? I mean, how do we make people turn out?
Anthony writes, the Republican Party has picked up the mantle of the old Southern Democratic Party. They're continuing to deconstruction the reconstruction. Marty says, gaffes, should I laugh at the stupidity or cry at the intractability of white men's inability to grow morally? Pete says, Obama's the first that's so clean and articulate. That Joe Biden said Obama's the first that's so clean and articulate. Look it up. Not hard to find, Pete in Kent. We've gotten a couple of letters from people about things that Biden has said in the past that were racial in nature, but... And I'm not saying that they were right, but isn't it different, David, when you also have this history of the Republican Party and of Mitch McConnell of trying to stop the rights of people of color that you do not have with Biden?
Absolutely. The fact that, first of all, I won't even entertain the false equivalence of people using phrases at one time were complimentary, and since that time, we now understand that, you know, that's offensive. I'm not going to create that false equivalence when you have people that are overt in their opinions and their bigotry, and sometimes they may not even say it. Mitch McConnell doesn't say many words, but his actions speak for him. And so when you look at Mitch McConnell's actions, over, you know, the decades and policies that have impacted negatively on minorities in our country, that to me is the only thing I need to see. I need to listen to. I don't need to have a press conference where he decides to taste his shoe to tell me all I need to know about Mitch McConnell. But I think, you know, there are important issues that lay ahead for us as a nation in order for us to move forward. I mean, we spend a great deal of time here talking about foreign policy. And the reality is we are a weak nation if we don't find that strength and pull together as a country.
All right. We are late, but we have to go. My apologies, but I hope you all have a beautiful and warm weekend. Thank you all for being a part of the program. Alan, thank you. We will be back with the Congressional Corner right after this.